From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. On June 29th, in a location expected to be large enough for hundreds of people, the man known as the East Area Rapist and Golden State Killer is expected to plead guilty to 88 charges of murder, rape, kidnapping, and more. The story by the Sacramento Bee broke yesterday afternoon. We have independently confirmed that the deal is in the works, though the district attorney's office says it is not going to comment until the day of the hearing. Margaret Wardlow was number 27 on the list of East Area Rapist victims. She was 13 when Joseph D'Angelo, who is the man charged with the crimes, broke into the house where she and her mom lived. This was in the La Riviera neighborhood of Sacramento, tied up her mom and then assaulted her. Margaret is joining us by phone from Palm Springs. Actually, I think she's on the road. Hi, Margaret. Thanks for talking with us again on Insight.
Hi, Beth. For having me.
So give me your reaction to the news of this possible plea deal.
Well, I was really surprised. Myself and a lot of people were surprised because kind of being out of the blue, we really thought that we would be consulted a little bit more possibly or asked what we really thought. So we were a little bit, I think the majority of us were kind of surprised. But we had heard wind of it. There had been rumor of it about 3 months ago, probably, I would say.
So how did you find out about it? And when you say us, who was the communication with?
Okay, so I'm myself as a victim, I am constantly in contact with the district attorney's office. And then through this whole thing coming about, and of course the arrest of Mr. D'Angelo, a lot of us women have been getting together and, of course, going to the hearings. And, you know, all the victims, family members of the murder victims, we've all been able to kind of get to know each other. And so that's who I'm speaking of. I'm speaking of people that are either victims or relatives of the murder victims.
Were you at any point, Margaret, asked your opinion and by whom of a possible plea deal?
Was I asked of what my opinion would be of a plea deal?
Yes.
No, I was not asked. Then that's kind of what I'm saying. We were really kind of surprised. I think that some of us are kind of disappointed. I think maybe that we weren't consulted more, perhaps. But, you know, it was completely up to the district attorney's office as to what was going to happen, I believe, you know. And then also you have to take into consideration this court, this entire process. Going to court, charging him, and having him plead innocent, we would have looked at millions of dollars, actually, of taxpayer money going towards this, all these court hearings and going to, you know, if we had to go through the whole trial. So it's probably for the best. But I mean, there's a lot of unanswered questions that many of us have, and they'll probably never be answered. Which, you know, they may have been. Had we gone to court.
So what are some of those questions for you? And did the death penalty option matter to you?
The death penalty option mattered to me only because I didn't want him to get it. And I'll tell you why. I think it's just too easy for him, and I'd rather see him out with general population and see him have to serve his days out, you know, with other convicts. And I mean, I think he's going to have a kind of a tough time. I think he's kind of a control freak, you know, to say the least. And I think it might be kind of hard for him if he's out in general population. And also, I just don't know if the death penalty is the solution for this. I'd rather, for me personally, I want to see him out having to figure out his way in the prison system. And, you know, he's not going to be top dog anymore like he was in his neighborhood. I guess he was kind of a mean old grouch in his neighborhood. And I don't think he's going to have a chance to be, you know, somebody that like that in prison.
So if some of your questions could be answered, what are those questions and what do you want to know, Margaret?
Well, initially speaking for the other victims, I think there's a number of victims that want to know why me? Why was I chosen? I think I kind of know why I was chosen. I think I was very active in the community, and I was out and about, and I was a kid, and I was going down to the river all the time. But I don't know. The question could be why was it me, or how did you pick me? Moreover, how did he get away with it for so long? I mean, I think there's some people out there that blame law enforcement, but I certainly do not blame law enforcement. I think they did as much as they could, and I think they did the best job they could. I don't know what my questions would be. My questions would be, does his wife know? Did his wife know anything about this? My question would be, like, are there items that he stole? Because he stole a number of pieces of jewelry. Did he give those to his daughters? Did he give those to his wife? You know, how much did she know throughout this whole thing? And then I've also heard some people question how much of this plea deal is part of what she wants, you know, as his wife. Because, as you know, she's an attorney. She's a prominent law attorney there, a family law attorney in Sacramento. So she's no, you know, she's no dummy. She knows that she may be called to testify. I know that she's been, you know, certainly questioned over this whole thing and how much she knew. So I don't know. There's a lot of questions, obviously.
In 2018, Margaret, a 100% DNA match made this all a reality. How has your life been different since then because of the certainty of his arrest, having attended the hearings, and knowing this is all for real, that he has been caught even though the final trial and sentencing hasn't happened?
It's been a lot of different emotions. It's been a lot of different feelings and realizations that I've had as a kid when it happened to me. I was very brave. I was very strong. I knew who was in my house when he came in. I said, you know, most likely this is the Easter rapist, and I was very defiant. You know, I told him, you know, he asked if I wanted to die. Do you want me to kill your mother? And I just replied, I don't care. But since then, going to court, it's been very frightening to be around him. It's been very frightening, and I think I've come to the realization that, you know, this guy is a killer. He's no one to toy with. And I really, not as a kid, I wasn't toying with him, but as a kid, I was being defiant and angry and, you know, more like indignant, like, what are you doing in my house kind of thing. And now I realize how, you know, how close I may have even come to being murdered. You know, the guy was certainly not afraid to kill people. So that's happened. And, I don't know. I mean, I think there's been a lot of revelations. I do wish that they would have caught him prior to the time that they arrested him. You know, I definitely wish that would have been the case.
Meaning that it would have been years earlier.
Yeah, years earlier would have been great. I would have liked to have seen him spend a considerable amount of his life in prison rather than just the remainder of it.
Margaret, your mom was 97 when we spoke last. She had some dementia, but I remember you saying one of your goals was to find a moment when she was more clear and she could understand you, and you would tell her that Joseph DeAngelo had been arrested for what happened in your home and to so many people across the state. Were you able to do that?
Yeah, I was able to do that. As soon as they had arrested him, I was just so overjoyed and so excited. My mom, as you stated, did have dementia. She's since passed. But I made sure I told her all the time, and it'd bring a little smile to her face, and she'd say, really? And she didn't speak a lot, but she did acknowledge that, you know, she understood what I was saying. And I made sure that I repeated it frequently because it was just such a major thing for her. I mean, it really upended her life, not being able to take care of her daughter and be able to protect me. And it really did a number on her, much more so than with me. I mean, I really felt like I kind of gave the guy a hard time, you know, when he was at my house. So, but my mother, unfortunately, didn't feel the same way. I mean, she knew I was strong. And she admired that in me, but she just had such a hard time grappling with the fact that her daughter had been assaulted.
I'm amazed, and I'll refer people to the link on our website to hear the conversation when you talked in detail about the assault. But I'm amazed that you believed even then as a 13-year-old that you were going to be okay, that you would survive the sexual assault that you experienced and be okay as a person. And it sounds to that full degree that that's happened. But how important has that sense of self been throughout your life because of what happened to you?
I think it's one of the greater achievements I've ever had in my life, to be honest with you. And really what saved me was just my pure curiosity and my interest in crime and also in what makes this guy tick? Why is he out there doing this? What's inside the mind of an assailant like this? You know, what's he thinking? What's he getting out of this? Because I know he's getting something out of it, but what's he getting out of it? So for me, I think that was really the thing that kept me going, and that was the thing that saved me, and that was the thing that really helped me to understand what strength I have inside.
What did you decide it was about him? I mean, in many, many stories and tellings of your story, we know the answer, but I want you to say again what it was that as a young person you pinpointed.
He just had to be a weak person, or like, what's wrong with this person that's so defective that he has to go out and do this to people? I mean, I think that was the main thing that I wondered about. Is that the question? I don't know if I'm answering your question properly.
Well, yeah, I think the flip side of that is because you saw him as a weak person, you believed that you could actually have some power in that situation.
All I knew is that he wanted to get satisfaction out of the fear that he was trying to provoke in his victims. And for me, I just, as a kid, just automatically knew that, hey, I'm not going to give him what he wants. I'm not going to give him that satisfaction. So if I just tell him I don't care if he kills me, I don't care if he kills my mom, I mean, where is he going to go with that? What's his comeback, right? So, yeah, that's all I could think of. And apparently that's called reverse psychology, which I would later learn, many years later. But that's kind of what I used on the guy. And he lost a lot of his mojo, I have to say. I think that he really, I mean, and then it was weird when he left, I was shivering and he covered me up with a blanket. You know, he asked, well, what's wrong? And I said, I'm cold. And he covered me up with a blanket, like almost like regretful maybe, or who knows what? Who knows what was going through his mind? I really don't know. I don't know. But I assume that he's just a weak person and had to get this, some kind of a satisfaction out of doing harmful things to others in order to get pleasure.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Margaret Wardlow. She and her mom survived an assault by the East Area Rapist on November 10th, 1977. A plea deal is reportedly in the works that would allow Joseph DeAngelo to avoid a death penalty trial. A statement from the Sacramento County District Attorney's Office reads, "Victims and their loved ones have a right to be heard, and all six DAs involved in the prosecution of People versus DeAngelo are working closely with the victims in this case to ensure their statements are considered by the court prior to sentencing. This is an active prosecution. We will have no further comment until we are in court on June 29th. So will you be able to be there on June 29th, Margaret?
Absolutely. I attend almost every single hearing. I think I've missed two. So I've been to almost every hearing. I plan on being at that hearing. I plan on being at the victim's impact statement hearing. And I've got a lot of good friends that I get to see up in Sacramento, which makes it really nice. I really enjoyed seeing the other victims. And we have a really great camaraderie. We all end up going over to Carol Daly's house, typically either before or after the hearing. And she has been just so gracious, such an incredible woman to all of us victims. I can't say enough great things about Carol Daly.
One more question for you, and that is, what is closure, Margaret? And is a life sentence for Joseph DeAngelo enough closure?
There's never going to be closure for people like Debbie Domingo, who lost her mother at 15 years old. The Cruz family, Michelle Cruz losing her sister. I don't think there's ever going to be closure for these people. For myself, I think so. I think so for me. But I think that if you've lost a family member, like in such a horrific act, I don't think there's ever any real, genuine closure. But it's certainly good knowing that he's behind bars and that he's not going to be getting out and he's not going fishing. He's not riding his motorcycle. And that gives me great pleasure just knowing that.
Hmm. Thank you, Margaret, for continuing to talk with us. I'm glad to hear that you're well, and perhaps we'll see you in Sacramento, too.
Thank you, Beth. It was so nice talking with you today.
That was Margaret Wardlow, and in May of 2018, she originally told us the story of the attack that happened to her and to her mom. We're going to post a link to that segment. It's at capradio.org/insight. Now we're going to change gears because California lawmakers took negotiations way into the hours of late yesterday and into the evening. They passed a budget to keep their pay intact, but the work on the package isn't done. And Cap Radio's politics reporter Nicole Nixon is on the phone with some key details. Hi, Nicole.
Good morning.
Give me a bit of the outline of the drama that was happening.
Well, there's sort of this tension because lawmakers met their statutory budget deadline yesterday, but what they passed is nowhere near the final product. And there's already this big cloud of, you know, the $54 billion deficit and uncertain federal aid hanging over this budget process. But the fact that they haven't reached a deal with the governor was also hanging over this, too. And I remember in the Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins said that, you know, they'd met their constitutional obligation, and now they have to work with the governor to meet the moral obligation to come up with a budget that works for everyone.
So what was in the package that passed, and is that important because the work is continuing and there will eventually be a budget somewhere in the July-August timeframe, right?
Right. So this I would call a placeholder budget. You know, they passed it solely to meet that constitutional obligation. I think a lot of the, what was in it was the governor and lawmakers are both sort of hoping for and budgeting for $14 billion in federal coronavirus aid. But the two, I think a lot of the disagreements maybe stem from, you know, what happens if that aid doesn't come through. Governor
right.
Gavin Newsom has been, you know, calling for, he put in a lot steeper cuts in his budget, essentially cutting $14 billion if that aid doesn't materialize. And the legislature would lean a lot more heavily on state reserves, the rainy day fund, and cut only about $7 billion if that aid doesn't come through. So there are some other disagreements about oversight and the governor's pandemic response. But it's unclear, you know, what the actual sticking points are between these two groups right now as they continue to negotiate.
So that's why we will see a to be continued as this goes on. All right, Nicole, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's politics reporter. You can find more budget news at capradio.org. And let me shift the conversation one more time. We are now going to go to COVID-19. Because more and more we're hearing the word asymptomatic. Researchers are working to understand what this means in the body. KPBS science and technology reporter Shalina Chatlani looked closer at this. She joined us yesterday during coverage of Governor Gavin Newsom's noon press conference, and she's back with us now from San Diego. Hi, Shalina.
Hi, good morning, Beth.
Let's begin by defining asymptomatic. It's easy to say, that means there's no symptoms, but it's more than that.
Yeah, you know, simply put, it means that you're infected with a disease like coronavirus, but you're not showing symptoms. But more deeply, it means that your body isn't having a noticeable immune response, and therefore you're not detecting that you are infected with a virus.
So is there a sense of how many of the COVID positive people are asymptomatic? This is just such tough science to pinpoint.
Yeah, it is definitely really tough. And what I'll say is that scientists are learning new factors around what exactly it means to be asymptomatic every single day. If you think about when coronavirus really took off, earlier this year, scientists really didn't even know what the basic symptoms of coronavirus were. And now we're learning more, you know, loss of taste, loss of smell. And so when it comes to asymptomatic cases, we are just crunching the numbers on that. Locally in San Diego, public health officials say just about 10% of the tests that they have been conducting have come up with positive coronavirus cases among people who are asymptomatic. You know, there's emerging research nationally that's very variable about that number, but I'll refer to some recent research from Scripps Research over here in San Diego that was published by cardiologist Dr. Eric Topol in the peer-reviewed journal Annals of Internal Medicine. And he studied 16 different cohorts of patients around the world that were tested and found that 30 to 45% of people could be asymptomatic and spreading the virus. One of the most interesting parts of that research showed a study of around 3,000 positive coronavirus cases among prisoners across numerous different states, and over 96% of them were asymptomatic.
Wow. Wow. I think that there might be a false sense of security in thinking that if you're asymptomatic, you're kind of out of the water. But I believe you talked about this with Dr. Topol, too.
Yeah, exactly. And he said that was the most surprising part of his research. And he phrases it really well in the interview with me.
People can go through a whole infection and not know it at all. But the other thing that we uncovered, Shalina, that was a surprise to us, and I don't think most people know this, is that even though you don't have symptoms, which is silent enough as it is, there's another level of silence, which is you can have internal organ damage and not know it.
Shalina, let's say a little bit more about that, because we already established that your body might not be giving a heightened immune response, but he just said you could still be experiencing internal organ damage?
Right. So he's referring to one of the studies among the 16 different groups that he reviewed, and researchers had looked at lung scans on asymptomatic patients that were aboard the Princess Diamond cruise ship. If you recall, that was a cruise ship that was off the coast of Japan that, you know, there were a number of cases and patients had to stay on the ship. But when they came back to shore and doctors did lung scans, what they found were that of the people who were asymptomatic, over 50% saw abnormalities in their lung scans. So this research is among a handful of new studies that are coming out showing that coronavirus can have these impacts internally. And we're just beginning to understand this and really learn about it. So what Topol is saying is that we really need to study more about what coronavirus is doing not only on our lungs, but in other organs, like the heart, for example.
Right, because the new research that's emerging is based on how many people?
So, you know, that's a really good point. Topol addressed this in his interview with me. You know, we have around 2 million cases nationally that are recorded. But experts say, you know, with asymptomatic cases, it's probably more like 10 million. And so that gap, he says, can be explained by, you know, lack of testing, people having false positives. If they do get tested, which means that, you know, they get a test and it comes back and it says that they're negative, but actually they have coronavirus. But even that figure, if we're extrapolating it, it's still a really small percentage of the U.S. population. There are around 300 million people in the United States. So now that we're reopening up, it's safe to say that we could see a big bump, especially if testing grows tremendously. That, for example, happened in San Diego. We were seeing around 4 to 5% positivity testing rate. And then all of a sudden, we started increasing our testing, and we saw in the last week, an 18% positivity rate. That's what happens when all of a sudden you're testing more. And so, you know, the last thing I'll say about that is the guidance in this country for the longest time has been don't get a test unless you're symptomatic. And so public health officials are going to have to do a lot of work to say, hey, you know, if you went out to a protest that weekend and you were exposed to a lot of people, maybe you should go get a test.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with KPBS science and technology reporter Shalina Chatlani. We're talking about the status of asymptomatic with COVID-19. Let's move on to one other point here, and that is about shedding the virus. So you're not experiencing symptoms, but you may still, in some ways, be giving off particles, at least, of the virus. What about that aspect?
Yeah, so, you know, like I said earlier, we are still learning so much about what it means to be asymptomatic. And the reason why we don't know that much is because simply people haven't been getting tested who are asymptomatic. And so I asked Dr. Sumit Chanda about this. He's a virologist at the Sanford Burn and Prebys Medical Discovery Institute. And here's what he had to say about that.
Typically, if you're shedding virus as a person, it means you're making virus. And there's going to be a reasonable percentage of those virus particles that are going to be viable and transmittable.
I think that's why we're being told asymptomatic still means infectious potentially to other people.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, with the state of testing in our current capacity and knowing that some tests can come up with false positives or false negatives, basically the guidance is if you have gone to places where you think you could have been exposed, it's very likely that you could have gotten coronavirus and you may be asymptomatic and you could be shedding the virus. Because Chanda's point is, you know, in a world where we still don't have enough data on how asymptomatic people are infecting other people, you would assume that if you are infected, you are making virus particles and you have the potential to spread those virus particles. And I know we have a limited amount of time, but I just want to give like a metaphor here that could really drive this home for people. It takes, you know, maybe a few thousand viral particles to infect someone. A 1 micron of virus is 1/50th the diameter of a human strand of hair. And that little tiny bit can hold up to 1,000 virus particles. So if you imagine a sneeze or a cough, you have a really high potential to spread.
Let's listen to a little bit more from your conversation with Dr. Chanda.
Listen, people aren't going to the doctor to get tested if you're asymptomatic, right? So we don't really have a good grasp on what, you know, the different outcomes of an asymptomatic person is, because we just don't know how to find them and track them and study them in large enough numbers.
That's right. Asymptomatic people right now aren't necessarily going to be trace followed. So let's wrap this up, Shalina, with aside from the argument for everyone to be tested, which is really difficult and ever changing, what's the best advice right now as we learn more and before we really understand this?
I think, you know, the best advice is to be smart. You know, if you are going out into public places and you think that you could possibly be exposed and you're not experiencing symptoms, the guidance from public health officials is monitor your symptoms. And if you start to see something, you know, go get tested. As soon as you feel like something is coming up, you know, public health officials are opening up testing more and more. Don't feel like you have to wait. You can go get those tests.
All right, Shalina, I thought that it was an important conversation and there's something in there for all of us to learn. Thanks so much for making time to talk with us today on Insight.
Absolutely.
That was Shalina Chatlani, KPBS science and technology reporter. We'll post a link to some of her stories. There was more local news that captured quite a bit of attention yesterday. Sacramento's mayor proposed a plan for reform in the city's police department. He called for an inspector general and a redefining of the role of police officers. Then later in the day, a bronze statue of John Sutter at the Sutter Health Building in downtown Sacramento was taken down, as Sutter Health said, quote, it wanted to do this out of respect for community members' viewpoints. So you can find coverage of both of these stories at capradio.org. Up next, we are going to talk with Rick Cushman about the wine industry in the midst of the pandemic. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.